March 13th.
Move those.
March 13th, minutes have been moved.
Corrections?
All in favor, any corrections? All in favor of March 13th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. And then we have two sets of unofficial minutes for hearings that took place during the interim on October 2nd. Can I get a motion to approve the minutes of October 2nd?
Mr. Chair, I second the minutes.
October 2nd minutes have been moved. All those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say aye. And then the last, of course, is some unofficial minutes for January 22nd.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the minutes for January 22.
Again, not an official meeting and not committee members there. But all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay? Okay. Motion carries. With that, we're going to get right into the agenda. The first bill up is House File 3068. It's my bill, so I'm going to turn the gavel over to Vice Chair Painter. Honor.
Chair Dean, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3068 to be referred to Government Operations.
Okay.
So I'll quickly explain the bill so folks know. As you know, a few years back, we moved to a presidential national primary from our caucus system. And in the process of doing that, we as a legislature did some things, and we're now finding out that the things that we thought we did maybe weren't exactly the same as we had originally intended. And so 3068 is brought forward to make it so that the data access that is available to the parties will go to the parties and will be primarily just for their use, not for wide distribution, as we're finding could be the case. And then we also have a voter opt-out option in this bill, but I could go on and on about this for quite some length, but I currently have Secretary Simon here, who would probably run through some of the provisions of the bills and why we put them in place. So I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I really appreciate it. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thank you for being here at this evening hearing. So I just want to zoom out just a little bit. I mean, a number of you were here in 2016, but in 2016, the legislature made the move to a presidential primary. Really, the caucuses were a victim of their own success in many ways. I think every legislator here probably attended a caucus in 2016, and you know turnout was really robust on both sides of the aisle. For all the obvious reasons, a lot of energy, a lot of excitement, and it literally overwhelmed the ability of volunteers from the political parties to handle. There were classrooms meant for 30 or 40 that were asked to accommodate 130 or 140, parking lots that were full, hallways that were clogged, and the legislature in 2016 took notice and said, enough, we're going to keep caucuses, but for this one contest every 4 years, we're going to lift it out and shift it over, and we're going to run it on a parallel track as a real election with real ballots in real polling places and real election judges. And, you know, at the time, there was a debate about whether to record party preference. I and many, I think, on this committee thought that was not a good idea. But the national parties insisted, both the RNC and the DNC insisted that this be a so-called closed primary. And in most states in the country, that's easy to do because they have party registration. So if you're in Connecticut or California or Iowa, for that matter, and you want to do a closed primary where only Democrats can vote in the Democratic contest, only Republicans in the Republican contest, you just say, simple, register Democrats only, register Republicans only. But we don't do that. We never have since statehood. I think that's a good thing. And as a result, the political culture in Minnesota, at least in my judgment, is that most people don't like to wear their party affiliation on their sleeve. They're not used to signing up as a Democrat or Republican. They just register plain and simple. So how do you do a closed primary in a state like ours that doesn't have party registration? The answer, the uneasy answer, is you have two separate ballots, or as many separate ballots as there are major parties. It, as it so happens, only two of the major parties are participating, Democrat and Republican. So while it's not an ideal situation, and it doesn't feel good for the legislature or any of us to feel like we're bending state statute to the will of a national political party, the legislature has already approved the primary. I don't think any of us want to spend millions of dollars on what would otherwise be just a beauty contest with no meaning, because what the national parties were saying is if you don't do it this way, they were threatening to not recognize the primary, in essence, and award zero delegates to both the Republicans and the Democrats to their national convention. So legislators in 2016, including some of you, were in a tough spot, and so the uneasy accommodation was doing these separate ballots to fulfill the party rule requirements in both the national parties. So last session, a number of us worked together to change the law to at least make the information about who chose what ballot not public. I think that was really a step in the right direction. But unfortunately, during the final closed-door negotiations at the end of session, in which none of us in this room that I know of were in the room, otherwise we might have stomped our feet a little bit, the final outcome was, yes, to make it not public, but was to say for the first time that all four major parties in Minnesota, all four, would get the record of which party's ballot a voter chose. Obviously, no one will ever know which candidate a voter chooses. We have a secret ballot, but they will know, did the voter choose the DFL ballot or did the voter choose the Republican ballot? That information, that list, will be handed over to all four major parties, not just the party of the voter's choice, but all four. Now, current law places no restrictions whatsoever on what the parties can do with that data, and that's what particularly is distressing to a lot of people. And I think it's common practice, as we all know, from our own races, for political parties to share data with friend groups, with vendors, with allies of all kinds. And right now, there simply are no limitations. So, for example, could one of the parties post the list online? Just post it. Say, hey, Minnesota, here's the list. If you want to know which of your friends, neighbors, co-workers, employees, employers, members of your religious congregation, you want to know which one of them chose a Republican ballot or DFL ballot, here you go. Could they do that? Yes, they could. Could they sell it? Yes. Could they give it to anyone they want? Yes. That's our interpretation legally. So the problem that has come up, as you can imagine, is a lot of people object to that, not just on philosophical grounds, but based on what they do for a living. So whether it is city or county or state employees, including some legislative employees I've heard about, whether it's members of the clergy or journalists or small business owners or others, you know, in today's cancel culture, they don't particularly look forward to the risk, and it is a risk, that their choice of party ballot getting to four different political parties, their own and three others that are not their own, with no restrictions whatsoever in the law on what they can do with it, is just too big a risk. So many people are opting out. One anecdote from earlier this afternoon, just earlier this afternoon, I spoke to a county elections person in charge of a, you know, fairly large county's elections. And he said to me, this was just a few hours ago, he said exactly half, exactly 50% of the people who have come up to the counter in his county so far to vote absentee in the presidential nominating primary, one half exactly, have turned away and said no thanks once they learned that the rule is that they would have to designate a party ballot and choose it. So the least we can do, it seems to me, is to give the people who are willing to do that some comfort and some peace of mind that when the data about which party's ballot they chose is distributed to political parties, that at least there are some ground rules and there's some guardrails. So the solution here is this bill, and the bill does three things. First, it gives this information to a single representative of the party's national committee, and only for the purpose of verifying compliance. That's what they said they needed. That's what the RNC and DNC needed. They said, we just want this data, according to our party rules, a so-called recordation requirement. Their recordation requirement requires that they get it so that they can verify participation so that there were no crossovers. If that's true, this sort of takes them at their word that that's all they need it for, and that's the only permissible use of the data. The second thing that the bill does is it designates the data as private under the Data Practices Act, and it forces anyone receiving this data from the parties, those national representatives, to sign an acknowledgement with the force of contract that the state data practices law applies. As many of you know, typically when data leaves government hands, it typically loses its Data Practices Act designations. The minute it leaves public or government hands, but there are many places in statute where we do this, which is by contract basically bind them to the same terms that apply to government. And so that's the intent here. And number three, an opt-out for voters. So they can do what voters can already do in other election circumstances. In fact, right now, if you go to our website, there's a form on there for people in different contexts, different circumstances, to take their name off certain lists. So this would be that. That could be done either at the polling place or more likely afterwards, and they could go either in paper or online and have their name taken off the list. So that is the bill. And I think the deadline, the only other thing to say from the standpoint of the legislative calendar is the deadline for getting this done is not March 3rd. Some of you may be thinking, and I wouldn't blame you, can this really get done in 2.5 weeks? That's not the deadline. The deadline is 10 weeks after March 3rd when the data is due from the counties. And it's at that point only that our office, under the current law, would have to turn it over to the four political parties. So there is time to do this and time to make enough progress to give voters who vote on or before March 3rd the confidence that they can take that risk. They can participate in the primary without fear about the absence of any downstream limitations on what the parties can do with this data. So with that, members, thanks for your time and your consideration.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, do you have another testifier?
We do.
Do we want to answer questions first for the secretary, or would you like to move to the next
testifier? Why don't we wait till the end? Can you hang around for a few minutes? Okay.
Okay.
Nick Harper with the League of Women Voters.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Harper. If you could just state your name for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nick Harper. I'm the Civic Engagement Director for the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. We do not support or oppose any candidates or parties for office, but our mission is to empower voters and defend democracy. We think that this bill is good progress on the issue of voter privacy for the presidential nominating primary. Voter privacy is paramount and important to ensuring that voters are comfortable with the voting process and that they're able to participate in the process with trust. And this bill does make some progress. Secretary Simon listed several types of individuals who might not feel comfortable participating in this process because they feel like their party affiliation might be revealed to the public, which may then somehow damage their personal, professional, or business, their personal, professional, or business lives. And the League has heard many of those same concerns from many of the same folks. We've heard from people who have been volunteer election judges who may no longer volunteer as election judges if that information becomes public. We've heard from people who work at nonprofits that rely on state-funded grants. We've heard from local government staff. We've heard from state government staff. We've heard from people who live in rural Minnesota who don't want to even tell their election judge their party. We've heard from folks who live in urban areas who feel like their party affiliation differs from their neighbors, and they don't want that information to be shared. We've heard from voters across the state. We think that this makes pretty good progress on this issue. We'd love to see there be more discussion about how to improve it even further, if possible. We know that there is some delegate balance with the parties because the parties have require this information to be shared in a certain way, otherwise they will not recognize delegates from the state of Minnesota at their party conventions. So we recognize that there is a challenge and a balance there, but we would be happy to work with anyone in order to make this more of a success for voters. We know that there is another bill by Representative Scott that has something similar, and we think that's also a great bill, but we understand that that might not be practical in terms of what the parties require. So if it has to be something closer than this bill, We understand that the legislature has to make that calculated choice.
Thank you, Mr. Harper. And then we also have Marie Ellis. Thank you, Ms. Ellis. And if you could state your full name for the record and go proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Bonner and members of the committee, good evening. My name is Marie Ellis. I'm the Public Policy Director at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. MCN is based here in St. Paul. We're a statewide membership organization representing over 2,200 nonprofits across the state. Our members are heavily invested in strengthening their communities. Among other things, they, of course, promote democratic building blocks like voting and participating in the census. And so we, representing our members, are very concerned about the way that this law is written for the presidential primary for two reasons. First, with no rules around how the data on the voter party preference list is to be protected, there's serious concern about the list becoming public. Our 501c3 nonprofit members are required by law to remain nonpartisan. The idea that voting record of their leadership or their staff could become public and could be used to hassle or discredit them is having a chilling effect on primary participation from our members. Our second concern is more global, and I think Secretary Simon and my colleague at League of Women Voters did a good job talking about the different sectors of the electorate who will be disenfranchised. So I'll just add that voters have to weigh the risks and the rewards of voting in the primary, and we are going to see a decline in our nation-leading voter turnout. So if we want to uphold Minnesota's rich tradition of privacy, and we hope that you all do, there are two steps that we urge you to implement. First would be to either decline to collect the data in the first place, or if it's deemed necessary, to protect that with appropriate safeguards to ensure that it can only be used for the intended purposes. And with that, of course, must come penalties for violation of the privacy of our state's voters. Second, we urge you to provide voters with the opportunity to opt out of having their information included on any database as a result of their decision to vote. The bill before you today, House File 3068, includes both of those mechanisms, and we're happy to strongly support this proposed legislation. We urge you to vote in favor of the bill and to talk to your colleagues about the importance of this change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. Do we have any additional members in the audience that are not on the list that would like to testify? Seeing none, let's open that up to member questions. Members, do you have any questions for any of our testifiers here today or for Chair D? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Simon, I heard you use the words election a couple of times in the opening comments and remarks that you made. And I also heard you use a term that I've heard you use a number of times, and it's a term that I've actually been able to use to explain to people what's actually happening here. And you use the word election, and it's really not a bona fide primary election that we would see in August, potentially June at some point. We'll see what we can do with that as that one continues to hang in the corners of the conference rooms as a possibility. But to the point, we use it's a beauty pageant. The political parties are the ones who are selecting the candidates and people putting themselves forward. There is no statutory requirement or legal requirement for anyone to attend the precinct caucuses in the state of Minnesota. Am I correct on that, Mr. Secretary?
Secretary?
Madam Chair, Representative Russell, that's correct.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Woodruff.
Secretary Simon, is it also true that there is nothing that's compelling anyone to attend what we'll call the beauty pageant, kind of using your word from earlier this evening?
Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Representative Woodruff, that's true.
Madam Chair, if Secretary Simon, so what in the past has prevented someone from collecting data of individuals who may go to the Republican location, an elementary school in a community, versus the Democrats who go to a middle school in a community, where they're completely separate and it's very publicized that people would know where Democrats are going and where Republicans are? and be it that it's public property and everyone has at least one of these available to them with pretty good resolution and graphics from videoing the individuals that walk into that, later identifying and composing a list of here's the people that we saw walk in. Is there anything in their current state law that prohibits that activity from happening, Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, no, I don't think so.
Madam Chair, if I could.
Yes.
Mr. Secretary, is there anything that prohibits people from using that same device to take down license plate numbers of vehicles that are in the parking lot to further collect and tie that information back to potentially get addresses for those individuals?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, no, I know of no limitation.
So, Mr. Secretary, there are ways where people can get this information already if it is something that they desire. Am I correct?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, yes, but on a much smaller scale, obviously. They could figure out a particular place, but the point I would make is just a matter of scope and scale. I mean, this is a massive list of potentially hundreds of thousands of people beyond the capability of one or even a group of people to snap some, you know, pictures in a polling place. So, yes, I mean, the answer to your question is yes, people can do this, but the distinction I would make is just a matter of the scale.
Madam Chair. Mr. Secretary, also, an individual who goes to a, well, let me step back. It was asserted tonight in some testimony that we heard that some individuals need to make their political affiliations private and not make them public. Would those individuals be more inclined or less inclined to attend a Democrat, Republican, marijuana one, marijuana two party, you know, the four major parties that you're talking about, make them more inclined or less inclined because of the need to keep that data private to attend a precinct caucus?
Chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
So let me put it this way. It was asserted this evening by the testifier from the nonprofits organization that those individuals need to keep their political affiliations private. My question is, do they then not attend? My assumption would be that they would not attend the Marijuana 1, the Marijuana 2, the GOP, the DFL precinct caucuses. So they are not bringing forward their political affiliations in that manner. So there would be a keeping of an oath, a employment requirement, requirement of their ethics, their standards of conduct, whatever the case may be, by not participating in that type of a beauty pageant that's instead of being done 1 hour on a Tuesday evening between 7, not to be done before 8 o'clock in an evening, versus opening it up and being more user-friendly and giving people the opportunity from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. to engage in that process and also have the ability to once again return to precinct caucuses and be identified again a second time for some political affiliation.
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll, I think you're asking my opinion, what is someone in that situation more likely to do? Was that the question?
Putting it out there, maybe it's more of a rhetorical question, but I see we have the person who provided the testimony. Perhaps they want to share some additional light on it.
Yeah, thank you. Again, Chair Bonner and members of the committee. So it's not that nonprofit staff need to be entirely nonpartisan in their personal lives, but in their work life, they do need to remain nonpartisan. I think the difference here, like Secretary Simon said, is a lot about scope and scale. So if a nonprofit executive director had chosen to go to a party caucus, the people at that caucus would know that they were there. In this case, if the list of which party's primary they had voted in became public, that would be to the entire state. And so everyone in the state would be able to see, I mean, if it's posted online or sold or something like that, everyone would then be able to see that. And I think there could be a case where it's not a big deal until it's public, right? And so no one's looking at a nonprofit to say, oh, I wonder how all of their staff vote. But if there's a list out there and you go, oh, that's surprising, then it becomes a way to potentially harass or discredit a nonprofit. And that's our concern.
Thank you, Ms. O.
Thank you.
Do you have any additional questions, Representative O'Driscoll?
Good for right now, thank you.
All right. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Secretary or the author, have you spoken to the, I guess, four major parties now regarding whether this complies with their prerequisite to not ban Minnesota from their, not that I believe that that would actually happen, but have you talked to them about whether this achieves that or not?
Mr. Secretary?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Nash. Yes, we have reached out to both the RNC and the DNC. Those were the only two parties, as far as I'm aware. I've not heard from either of the marijuana parties that they have national rules that have this requirement. But the two other major parties, yes, we've reached out to them both, the RNC and the DNC. The DNC was more specific, more explicit about the fact that they didn't believe, at least tentatively, and this was a couple weeks ago, that there was anything wrong here. The RNC, we haven't heard more specifics, but I will say I haven't heard a red light, and they're aware of this bill. But we assume that the two parties' provisions are much the same. They both use the same language, a recordation requirement. So we think this would be okay. We were specifically concerned, to be honest, about whether the opt-out provision would violate the party rules. And we're hearing at least tentatively that the DNC does not believe that it would violate their rules. We have yet to hear more specifically from the RNC.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Representative Nash?
And Madam Chair, thank you. Again, to the Secretary or the author, other states have presidential primaries. And one of your principal concerns, Mr. Secretary, has been that this list is going to get out in the wild. It's going to be posted online. You can probably buy a copy on Craigslist or something. Has that happened in other states?
Mr. Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nash, well, in most other states, they do it by party registration, so it's easy to do a closed primary, and it's not an issue because people are out there, they wear it on their sleeve, they're registering as Democrats, as Republicans, so that is, and that's actually a public record in those states, so anyone off the street can get that list. So it's hard to say. We're sort of in that weird ground here where we have a closed primary in a non-voter registration state. So it's hard to say. I guess the basic answer to your question is, have I heard of this happening anywhere else? No, but I don't know of any other state that has precisely our exact situation.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Representative Nash?
Yeah, just a quick follow-up on that, and maybe you can provide this later for me. Is this concern based in something that you've seen, heard, or is this just supposition? That the list is going to get posted online or sold or whatever?
Mr. Secretary.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Nash, I mean, we've never had this since really 1956. So to that extent, it's speculation. We had the one-off in 1992, but it was a little bit different. It wasn't binding. You really have to go back 64 years to 1956. So I think the problem is less that I believe Ken Martin or Jennifer Carnahan are going to post this online. That's not really the issue. I think the issue is voter confidence or voter speculation that they may. People who don't even know those people's names might say, well, look, you're here to tell me that four different political organizations are going to get the information about which ballot I took, and you're also telling me that they have no restrictions or limitations, and they're apt to say, with all due respect to the parties, I don't trust political parties. So I think it's as much about voter perception as anything else, as not wanting to chill the perception that their data is just getting out there. So, no, I have no evidence that any political party is planning to or would want to do anything bad with it. But I think voters perceive, rightly, because it's a fact, that there are no limitations on what they can or can't do.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm glad to hear that you couldn't buy this online in the 50s. I haven't liked this thing from the beginning. I voted against it in every stop along the way and on the floor because I foresaw a number of problems. But I just think that from my perspective, I don't know that I believe that parties are going to be as nefarious as one might posit on this. But I guess I understand some of the concerns, and that's part of why I've been against it the whole time. But anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other members? Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask our research person, Mr. Gehring, is the unauthorized collection of information, non-public data, would that be considered a misdemeanor under Minnesota Statute 13.09, like the license plate thing that Representative O'Driscoll was talking about?
Mr. Gehring.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, are you asking about the collection of data under this bill, or maybe I'm not following your question exactly.
Right. Well, would this be Representative O'Driscoll was talking about like the collections of license plates, information, that is that a misdemeanor under Minnesota State Statute 1309?
Mr. Gary.
Madam Chair, Representative Bernardi, so that activity isn't covered by this section of statute. That's right, yeah. He's talking about a separate set of actions a person might take, and I'm not certain off the top of my head what criminal penalties might apply to that activity or if it's prohibited at all. So this the penalties that are listed in this bill would be for misuse of the data for purposes that are not authorized in this section of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi, did you have any additional comments?
That's it.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, and I know we have a lot of things ahead of us this evening, and I appreciate the latitude, but Secretary, I want to ask one more follow-up topic with you. This is political parties going through their private right to be able to put their chosen candidate forward in a state or a national election. This is not a true bona fide election from the standpoint that where your office, while having some oversight and participation in this, is not of the same type that we would talk about a legislative election, a city council election, a gubernatorial election, county commissioner election, school boards at all. These are entities, political entities, that are setting a criteria which they wish to be able to conduct their selection process under, and no one is compelled to participate in that process, nor does it take away an individual's ultimate right to vote in bona fide elections in the state of Minnesota. Am I correct?
Mr. Secretary.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, yes, with one asterisk. And you've said, and I think you're correct, just as a general matter, this isn't like a typical election. No one's going to raise a hand and take an oath, and at the end of this, it's about allocating delegates to national conventions, but for purposes of statute, it is treated like an election. In fact, much of the enabling language for putting this presidential primary in statute defaults to explicitly treating it like an election. I'll give you one other example. We've gotten the question a lot in our office, well, if I'm 17 now but 18 by the time of the election, can I vote in the presidential primary? By the way, the answer is no. Please don't do that. Please tell your friends and neighbors and others with high schoolers, don't do that. That's illegal. And the reason that it's illegal is because the state constitution says any election, you must be 18 to vote. And this is defined in statute as an election. So for statutory purposes, it is treated as an election and all the same processes apply. I get what you're saying as a matter of just common usage. It's not a typical election, but it is statutorily an election.
Representative O'Driscoll.
And to that point, the guidelines, I think, are well-suited to follow current statute because people are used to that. They're familiar with that. It helps with not having two sets of rules of whether you vote one way one time, one way another time on that. But I think what we need to understand and be clear on is this is not your father's Oldsmobile election. This is a selection process put forth by political parties who in and of themselves are rather competitive in the nature within their selection processes, and their various, and in Minnesota, could be potentially four different major parties having candidates vying for a number of different elected positions. And so if they are comfortable with that, and statute says that, and that's what the parties came forward with, it gets to me to look a little kangaroo-esque to say, very close to an election after 4 years of this, that this is the time that we need to be making some of these changes that close to the process. People have already begun to cast their ballots, although you've pointed out that March 3rd is not the date. It's 10 weeks after that when your office would have to release the data. But once again, people have made decisions to go or not to go. And again, are we disenfranchising individuals this close to the election by changing the rules? For that, as you said, you've spoken to one county official who 50% of the people have said no thank you and walked away. How do we reach back to those people and bring them back in if we do a rule change and a game change this quickly before that election / selection process? And maybe it doesn't need an answer, maybe it's rhetorical, but the Secretary has some thoughts. I'd like to hear those.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Driscoll. Great points. One thing I would say, the objection that this county auditor voiced to me a few hours ago has to do with something that this bill wouldn't change, to be fair, which is the two separate ballots. So what he at least told me was people didn't like that, and this bill wouldn't change that. That's something what I was trying to convey, maybe unsuccessfully, was that that's something the legislature was really in a box. Those who wanted to move to a primary wanted to move to a primary, but they didn't want to do it in a way that would violate the party rules, because then it would all be for nothing. And so they acceded to, legislators did in 2016, this idea of separate ballots. I want to be clear, this wouldn't change that. So that's a rule that wouldn't be changed. I otherwise, though, have a different characterization of this. I know others have voiced some thoughts about the bill publicly, saying that this is changing the rules in midstream. I don't see it that way. This isn't changing the rules about time, place, manner, who you can vote for, how you can vote, deadlines. This has to do with data collection downstream from the election we've just had. So I don't see this at all as changing the rules in midstream. I see it as changing something that's very much downstream after the election, whose rules we've all settled and agreed upon happens. That's my characterization of it.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Do we have any additional member questions? I actually have some commentary that I'd like to bring forward. You know, certainly I can tell you anecdotally there was a question about whether folks are truly concerned about this and whether we think that it would drive down participation. I can tell you that I have spoken to dozens of folks in my own community. I've received letters and phone calls. I've even gotten calls from my own parents who are legitimately concerned about this data being out there. Minnesotans hold this data as something very sacred. They have always felt that way, and is one of the reasons why Minnesota does not openly discuss party. And I think one of the other parts of that is I live in the IT world, and we talk about data privacy, and I know my friends on the other side of the aisle tend to have a great reverence for the privacy of personal sensitive data. In fact, a couple of us at this table happen to work in the IT field in which this is vitally important. And when that is in fact the case, one of the first things that you do is you restrict who has access to that data. The first point of this bill does exactly that. It restricts who has access to the data. The second point of this bill actually goes down and talks about what can be done with that data, and restricting and putting guardrails around what can actually be done with that data so that people can feel that they have trust in the system, that they have trust in their vote. And I think that also is extremely important. And third, it gives us, as most Americans like, the option of opting out. And I think that that is also critically important. And while I certainly respect Representative Scott, I do not feel that her bill has done enough to address all of those particular issues. But I am, however, quite excited that this particular bill handles all three of those points. And for that reason, I think it is a great bill. And I am fully in support of it. I will say that. And I want to thank you, Chair Dean, for bringing the bill forward. And with that, do we need to move the bill? Yep. Chair Dean, would you like to?
Some closing comments, yes. Madam Chair.
Sorry.
So we know that in 2008, there were many Minnesotans that were out on a cold night, standing in line, couldn't get into their facilities where people were participating in caucuses. And as Secretary Simon mentioned, it happened again in 2016. This is something that some legislator in the corner came up with this great idea to do something like this. This is something that the people in Minnesota have said, that can't we do something that's a little bit simpler, a little bit more convenient for us to vote in the presidential and national primary? And, you know, many other states do it, and as is mentioned, we have a system that is somewhat unique. I think that, like many of us members on this committee and other folks in the legislature, we've gotten hundreds of emails from people saying, if my data is going to be available, I am not going to vote. And, you know, Representative Driscoll is correct. People don't have to vote in this election. And you know what? They don't have to vote in August. They don't have to vote in November. And if Representative Driscoll wants to work on a bill that would require all Minnesotans to vote, I'm happy to sit down and have that conversation with him. But that's the system that we have. And I think anything we do that can reassure the people of Minnesota who are coming out to vote that their data is going to be as secure as we can make it, because I don't know if we can make any data 100% secure, but as secure as we can make it, I think this is a good compromise from what we have previously had passed and had put in statute. And, you know, although the Secretary Steinman says we have till 10 weeks after the 3rd of March, I would like to have something that will give comfort to people before March 3rd when they actually go to their polling place to actually vote. And maybe some of these individuals that have walked away saying, no, I don't want to turn over my data, maybe they will come out on March 3rd to actually participate, knowing that we have done everything we can to secure their data. And they also have that option of trying to opt out or of actually opting out of their data being collected. So I think this is an effort where previous legislatures have passed something, and we're trying to remedy some of the concerns that people have had about that. And I would ask members to support this and that we move it to government operations.
Thank you, Chair Dean. I am not aware of any other amendments to House File 3068. There being no further discussion on the bill, Representative Dean, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Dean renews his motion that House File 3068 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those in or opposed say nay.
No.
The motion passes. Thank you, Chair Dean.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bonner. Appreciate carrying the gavel. We're now going to move into a section of the agenda where previous bills were heard, took much testimony regarding these bills, and ultimately they were laid over for possible inclusion into the elections omnibus bill. So my hope is that we can maybe discuss these if we need to for a minute or two. If members have some concerns, we can bring those up. But my hope is that we'll be able to get this through this section of the agenda rather quickly. So I personally would like to move forward with House File 673, Representative Lucero's bill on payment for security services added to allowable non-campaign disbursement lists, and that this bill be re-referred to government operations. Questions, comments, anybody? Great. Oh, there's an amendment. I believe we have an amendment, a DE1, and it appears that the changes. Do you all have this in your folder? So from the original bill, the significance of change, if I could turn it over to Mr. Gehring to speak to the changes from the original bill that we recently included.
Mr. Chair, so the DE1 amendment just updates the bill to reflect the language that was included in the elections omnibus bill last year. There were some amendments that you adopted in the process last session that aren't picked up in the introduced version of the bill, so that's what you see in the DE1.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Gehring. So there were a few changes we made along the way, and this just gets that bill back in that order of those changes. So any question, comments?
Mr. Chair, just procedurally, were all authors invited to be in attendance tonight to discuss their bills with the
Representative Driscoll, yes, all authors were invited to attend, and I did not tell them they had to be here.
Thank you.
Since our hope was it was looking at purely technical issues related to these bills and that we had, you know, thoroughly discussed them previously.
More than thoroughly.
Okay. With that, all those in favor of moving House File 673 as amended to Government Operations?
As amended.
Oh, I'm sorry. We actually didn't adopt the DE. I'm out of practice, you guys. It's been a while since we've been at this
chair. I'll move your DE amendment.
Okay. The DE is moved. All those in favor of the DE, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Okay. Now the bill is in the form we need it. All those in favor of re-referring House File 673 to Government Operations.
As amended.
As amended. Please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Okay. That one is done. So if we can get through the rest of those, that'll be great. I think now we're actually going to skip a little bit on the agenda and move to House File 1372, the Representative Long's bill that allows voters to join a permanent absentee voter list and that those absentee ballots will be required to automatically be sent to permanent absentee individuals on that list and that be re-referred to Government Operations. And there is a A1 amendment. I'll move the A1 amendment. I just gave you all the chance to jump in. The A1 will actually add to page 2, line 28, Secretary of State must prescribe a form for this purpose, and the effective date is also impacted as well. Any questions about the A1 amendment? All those in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. the amendment is adopted. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. Anybody want to vote no? Okay. Thank you. Thank you for keeping me on my toes tonight. So House File 1, I renew my motion to refer House File 1372 to Government Operations as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay?
No.
Okay. The motion prevails. The bill is on its way to Government Operations. Next, we have House File 1152, Representative Freiberg's bill, where county auditors are authorized to transmit ballots electronically to persons with disabilities. Do we have any amendments to that? I don't believe we do. Any questions, comments of members? Okay, this bill will be re-referred to Government Operations. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Okay, House File 1152 is re-referred to Government Operations. Okay, next we have House File 1818, Representative Bernardi's bill.
I have an amendment.
And Representative, would you like to move your House File?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1818.
To be referred to Government
Ops. Government Ops.
Okay.
And I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer.
Okay,
as well.
Would you like to speak to your amendment?
Sure. The A1 amendment is to when the effective date is, which will be the day following final enactment and applies to election conducted on or after that date.
Okay. All those in favor of Amendment A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Okay. Representative Bernardi, Your bill is in front of us in the order we want it. Would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'd like to renew my motion.
Chair? Yes.
Because of the timeliness of this bill, and I believe that there were some questions as to whether or not what Representative Bernardi is putting forward in this amendment was actually permissible under law or not. And I'd like to visit with the Secretary of State on that and maybe get an update for the committee as to some inquiries his office might have had relative to this and just give the committee the full background before we take action on this evening.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Driscoll. I think I know what you're getting at. Stop me or give me the sign if I'm not addressing your concern.
If not, we'll get to your topic later.
Pardon me?
If it's not, we'll get to your topic later.
No. This is. I think I'm addressing this. So I think what you're referring to is we asked for a formal opinion from the Attorney General's office on this. And just to give some perspective here, the reason that Representative Bernardi is bringing this bill forward is I think she's correct that is necessary under state law. There are jurisdictions that wish to engage in, whether you want to call it mobile voting or have polling places in a place for less than the entire 46-day absentee period. This can come from rural areas, this can come from urban areas. There are elections administrators who would like to say in a county, for example, hey, we'll be for 1 week in this community and 1 week in another community and 1 week in another community. Similarly, in urban areas for various neighborhoods, they'd like to be able to do that rather than the current state law, which says if you're going to have an absentee place to process absentee voters, you're either there for the entire 46-day period or not. There were some jurisdictions in Minnesota over the last couple of years who interpreted the law such that they thought current law, without Representative Bernardi's bill, authorized them to do that. Our longstanding position in our office, and I don't just mean me, I mean going back the last two Secretaries of State, Secretary Ritchie and Secretary Kiffmeyer, all three of us, our legal position has been that current law does not permit that, that you would need Representative Bernardi's bill in order to allow jurisdictions to do that. There were some jurisdictions in Minnesota that disagreed with our interpretation of the law. So we asked for a formal legal opinion from the Attorney General's office, and we got one, and it reflected our opinion, which is that Representative Bernardi's bill is necessary for jurisdictions to do this, with one caveat, an interesting wrinkle that we had never really much discussed. The Attorney General's office opinion said that up until 1 week before the election, that is the case, that no county, no city, no township could do what they want to do unless Representative Bernardi's bill becomes law. But they said in the 1 week period before the election, that is fair game for a jurisdiction to have a polling place open for 7 days instead of the whole 46. So in the 1 week before the election, their interpretation was you can do it, but for most of the rest, the vast majority of the absentee period, you can't. So the question has arisen, if someone wanted to do this, would you need a law change? And our longstanding position across three secretaries of state and now sort of ratified by the Attorney General is yes. In order to do this from day minus 46 to day minus 39, you would need Representative Bernardi's bill. Is that addressing the issue?
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Simon, we are on the same topic, and I guess I'd like to explore the timeline a little bit more. And I hate to look like we're television on here. On or about what day did you receive an inquiry from a local government asking whether or not this was legal?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, it wasn't so much asking us whether it was legal. It was we got wind that there were jurisdictions that were planning to do this or doing it. And we told them those jurisdictions at the time. I can't give you exact dates. I can get that for you. But we told them, you understand it's our longstanding position of this office across three secretaries of state that you can't do that. Now, we're fond of saying in our office, we don't have guns and badges. We don't have enforcement authority. We can't enjoin. We can't stop a county from doing it. We can share with them our longstanding position, but we can't stop them from doing it. Only you can give us that enforcement authority, and maybe you want us to have that authority, but we don't have it now. But we did reach out to every jurisdiction, and I think there were a couple jurisdictions, and we let them know of our opinion. Now I think we have a stronger case to make now that we have an AG's opinion, which it doesn't have the binding force of law, but it's persuasive, especially a published opinion, which this is.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, was the AG's opinion rendered before or after the elections?
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I'm looking towards Ms. Bonowitz. Yes, it was after. It was January 2nd, 2020. That's when the opinion was issued.
Representative O'Driscoll.
So that was in what year after the election of what year?
2019.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So the Attorney General's office renders an opinion, which I can get an opinion from an attorney, as you've done, on this. So if we believe that we need to have Representative Bernardi's bill in order to make this legal, and the Attorney General's office has rendered an opinion after the election, is it possible that if this is challenged, that election could have been votes that were received that could create some voter distrust in the process where the election rules were not being followed, where these pop up, or, as you said, a week here, a week there, come on and vote, the voting wagons coming through town, if I could use that cliche.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, that's a hard one. Are you asking whether a court might determine that or just whether a voter might think that?
Representative Driscoll.
I'm just asking what public perception would be that after the election had happened, we're asking for an opinion on something. We've moved forward. Now the legislature is entertaining a bill to make what was questionable in your office, saying, well, we don't think it's the way you should be doing business. I haven't, the secretary before me, we've always operated this way. After the election, after this practice was employed, the Attorney General's office has come forward and said, nope, we think that was okay post-fact of the election.
Mr. Secretary.
Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, I would just make one distinction, which is our longstanding position in our office is based on our reading of the current law. In other words, the opinion we gave was about what the law permits. I support Representative Bernardi's bill. It's a matter of policy. I would like to see that happen in the state of Minnesota. But my view is also that current law does not permit it for almost all of the. So though it's my personal preference that it happen, I think we need a law change to make it happen. So the opinion of the office was never, at least under me, I can't talk about Secretaries Ritchie or Kiffmeyer. It wasn't a policy perspective. It was saying no matter whether you're for Representative Bernardi's bill or against Representative Bernardi's bill, you need that bill. If you want this to happen, you need a bill. Current law doesn't allow it, at least for 39 out of the 46 days. So that's what we were getting at. Not so much should you. It was does the law permit it? And our legal position, not policy position, was that no, the law does not permit it.
Representative Driscoll, and please go through the chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So, Secretary Simon, so I think this probably will be the last set of questions on this topic. So the opinion of the Attorney General's office is just that. It's not an administrative law judge. It is not a judge in the courts. It's not the Supreme Court's ruling on this. It is the opinion of the Attorney General's office on this. And the opinion is just that, and it can be challenged. And so we may have had something, if someone wanted to challenge it, we could find out in the court system that opinion was just that. It's not the power of a judge. It's not a judgment. It is an opinion through the Attorney General's office. And I think that I want to just go on record stating that it's, even though the Attorney General's office has said, here's what our opinion is, they don't carry the weight of the judicial branch weighing in on whether or not that practice was valid or not under current law.
Mr. Secretary.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll, that's right. It's got persuasive effect, but not controlling effect. And so we sought the opinion because we thought it might persuade counties or cities to take a certain course of action. Basically, we were saying, look, we have one view, you have another view. Let's go to the Attorney General's office and see what their view is. But you're right. They're not forced to do that. We don't have enforcement authority anyway, and nor do they have to abide by that. One thing I will tell you that we warned all these jurisdictions, I mean, there were a couple when I say all, we told them that although we don't have guns and badges, we don't have authority, enforcement authority, it is possible that a plaintiff out there with standing to sue could sue you. You're opening yourself up to a litigation risk. So you may not agree with our interpretation, but there might be someone out there with standing to sue who might sue you and saying that you're violating state law, and they might win. We think they'll win. So if you want to roll the dice, you can do that. And so in seeking the AG's opinion, which is a rare thing, they don't do that many opinions. I think under the prior Attorney General, I think she did like a handful of opinions in her 12 years as Attorney General. They're just pretty rare. But we wanted to go to, we wanted to take that extra measure and seek one, and they agreed to do one for that purpose, to at least try to persuade them. You're facing some litigation risk here. So,
Representative.
Mr. Chair, this will be my final comment. Secretary Simon, I want to thank you. I think that you did the right thing. I think your view on this and that of the Secretary of State's office on the policy, and as you said, it's not a policy matter, but it's the interpretation of law. I tend to stand with the past Secretaries of State on this, and I do believe that the Attorney General's office got this wrong, and if they didn't, we wouldn't be here today, again, advocating for this particular bill if it was clear in law. Fortunately or unfortunately, there wasn't litigation on here, so we'll never know. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. I don't know. But I want to thank you because I think your office sent something there and did what needed to be done by asking for the opinion. And I, again, stand with your interpretation of the facts.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
I have a question for the Secretary.
Oh, yeah, I guess you can't go. Welcome back to the testifier state, Mr. Secretary. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary, you'd mentioned a lawsuit that would likely happen. What would that look like? What help us understand so that we can maybe better act on this bill? Help drop a little knowledge bomb on us, maybe.
Mr. Secretary.
You know, Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I mean, just generally speaking, some plaintiff with standing to sue, I'm not an expert, but I assume somebody who lives in the jurisdiction, you know, a voter, I assume, I'm just riffing here, but could sue and seek some sort of declaratory judgment, perhaps, from a court that what the city in which they live did was not permitted under state statute. I don't know if that would be timely now or ripe, as they say, in the courts to do now, if that's the idea that someone now could sue over something that was done in the 2019 election. I just don't know, and I don't know how successful they would be at this point. That's just speculation. But the general idea, and we warned them of this at the time, was, you know, you may not agree with our interpretation. We're seeking an AG's opinion. We think you're wrong. We can't force you, but you're rolling the dice here. And that's what we told them.
And Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Nash.
I was hoping I maybe could get Mr. Gehring to give us a little.
You and I are thinking alike. Mr. Gehring, if you'd like to speak to this as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, so there is a formal election contest period that occurs after every election. I don't know the specific number of days for a local election, but that's the period in which a voter or other person with standing could challenge the results of the election. And I think, you know, certainly at this point, that period is closed now from the 2019 general election, so I'm not certain that there would be standing anymore for someone to sue based on those results, but there is a window of time when someone could do that. And I think it's like 10 days after the election is finally canvassed.
Representative Nash.
That's fine.
Okay. Any other questions or comments from members for Secretary Simon, since we still have him there? Great. Thank you again, Secretary Simon. Any other questions or comments about the bill that's before us?
Can I renew my motion now?
Would you like to renew
House File 1818 as amended to be sent to Government Operations Committee.
Okay, the bill is before us to be referred. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, nay. Okay, the bill is on the way. And now we have House File 2050, Representative Farmer, if you'd like to move your bill. And I see you also have an amendment in there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 2050. And I do, or I'm sorry, which, do you want me to start with the amendment?
Well, the bill is before us, so yes.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the A2 amendment, which changes the dates.
Any discussion on Amendment A2? All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed, nay. Okay, the bill is in the shape you want it. Would you like to speak to your bill, or tell us what it does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I would like to move House File 2050, which basically expands the definition of express advocacy and establishes a regulating of electronic or electioneering communications for the purposes of campaign finance law. But more specifically, what it does is it allows for transparency so that voters, when receiving communications in the mail leading up to an election, have the ability to understand who is behind those communications so that they can use them, that information, to make an informed judgment on their vote.
Thank you for the recap, Representative Boehner. Any questions or comments from committee members? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2050.
To be referred to government operations.
To be referred to government operations.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. The motion carries. You're on your way to government operations. So we've gotten through two parts of the agenda. We have one last part, and it will be an information discussion regarding House File 983, which we have previously. Yeah, we went through House File 1152, did we not? Yeah, we did. I thought so.
Sure.
Yes.
There was some confusion from whether this bill was being heard or not, whether it was pulled or not.
Yes. I'll thank you, Representative Nash. This bill was originally on our agenda, and then it was pulled, and now it's back. But since it was pulled, we can't take official action on it. So this is just for discussion, and this bill will come back before us on our next meeting, which will be Wednesday. And I was hoping that we could do a lot of the conversation now. There might be some recap and then take official action. It will really be up to folks about how much conversation they want to have. But I Representative Elkins is here, and I'd just like him to renew in our minds what this bill is and what it does, and then we'll move on to conversation and discussion. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for the confusion, but we received a number of good but small technical suggestions for amendments to the bill, and I just feel I requested it to be pulled because I think I'd feel more comfortable if we were able to discuss the amendments before we moved it along. So we heard the bill last year. It basically will allow local jurisdictions other than charter cities to adopt ranked choice voting as their form of election. And this includes counties, statutory cities, school boards. Ranked choice voting is just allow you, basically you rank your votes from 1 to N based on your preference. The other thing that the bill will do will standardize the form of the ballot for these kinds of elections for both charter and statutory cities and other local units of government. So the nature of the amendments and the real error technical is mostly things like changes in definitions and minor changes in wording, but there are several of them. I could go through them if the chair and the committee would like.
Representative Elkins, I don't know if we need you to go through them, but I wanted you here so that if questions came up, individuals could raise those questions. My hope is that we have brief discussion and we move this forward and we all get on with our evenings. But, you know, we'll see what members have. Members of the committee, any questions, comments, things that they would like answered?
Mr. Chair, just procedurally, what are you intending to do with this? That was a brief, probably the most brief informational hearing I've ever had. But what's the plan? Are we bringing amendments at the next time? Are we going to relitigate it, as you talked about in the office today? What's the plan?
Representative Nash, I believe that the intent here is there may be some technical changes that might come forward with amendments when we actually take the bill up that we might have conversations about. But, you know, House File 983 is substantially the bill that we spent
quite a bit of time on
one evening discussing with...
It's an important part of my education as a new legislator.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm open to taking some testimony from the public. If you all are anxious to do some of that, I don't feel a great need. I think we took much testimony previously. I mean, I appreciate the public that's here tonight regarding this particular bill, but...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, this is a very brief informational hearing. You're talking about amendments coming forward. Are we going to do a full run-through of the bill again when we talk about amendments? I would imagine that that's going to happen, so I'm just wondering what your plan is.
Representative Nash, my plan is to bring it up in the similar manner that the previous bills were brought up.
With full testimony, sir?
Well, we'll have testimony regarding the amendments.
Okay.
Because there will be some changes, and we want to make sure that members are fully aware of those changes, what they might be, and before we move this forward on to government operations. Representative Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, and you can take it for what this advice is worth, but since we don't have the amendments and we don't know which areas are affected by this, if you would like to lay this over once we get the amendments and members have a chance to look at them, that may help them to focus their questions to or away from topics once they know what the amendments and the affected areas are. So it might just be more efficient use of your time and the committee's time to wait until such time that we know what the amendments are going to be.
Representative O'Driscoll, I'd be happy to lay this over, but this bill really isn't before us. This is informational.
So however, procedure, however you want to do it. I guess if you're saying taking testimony, even the members of the public don't know what the amendments are, so they wouldn't know what they're testifying to, for, or up or down, because they don't know what parts of the bill are affected. I may have a position that I say I absolutely don't like, and you go, yep, oh, that part's been deleted. Then why do we take everybody's time to look at that? And until we have the amendments before us, like we did this evening, we kind of go, okay, that's not a problem, that's good, where we're at, and people maybe have some opinions from previous testimony as to the spirit and intent of the bill and whether they're supporting it or not. But once they get the amendments, it may or may not help them to change position.
Sure. Representative Driscoll, the reason this bill is before us in this manner is because it was on the original agenda. Some things happened. It was pulled. I wanted to have an opportunity for the author and the public to know that this is a bill that's being considered, and we will actually consider that vote at our next meeting on next Wednesday.
And, Mr. Chair, again, I think it's helpful to everybody and a good use of committee time and yours and the public's time once we know what those amendments are, so that we know what changes to the bill, since we have, in everyone's words and recollection, spent a substantial amount of previous committee time.
Representative O'Driscoll, that is the plan for Wednesday, to talk specifically about those amendments and have those addressed prior to moving the bill on to government operations. If there's no other questions or comments regarding the procedure moving forward with this bill, this meeting stands adjourned.